Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nothing can make you feel quite as inadequate as being a parent sometimes. There are battles you win, battles you lose, and battles you have to choose on a daily basis. But while people around the world and around the corner may have different child-rearing styles, we all pretty much have the same goal. We want our children to be honest. We want them to be loving, and we want them to be contributing members of our communities. Do you have a secret to child-rearing? Have you rejected how you were raised and gone in a different direction with your own children? Give us a call and share your story. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. Coming up later, we're going to hear from a full-time mom who also has a bachelor's degree in early childhood education and a master's in education. She also was in the trenches working 5 years at a child care facility on the OSU campus. So we'll find out from her how the theory stacks up to real life. Joining us now is author and Columbus native Heather Shoemaker. She's written a new book on parenting. It's called It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you. Good to be here, Ann.
So you say that the time for this book is now. Why now?
Well, now is a time where we've seemed to have forgotten what childhood is like and what young kids really need. Right now, we know more about how young children's brains develop than at any other point in history, but we're almost doing the opposite. So there's a huge disconnect between what we know about young kids and what we're doing with them. And it's time to bridge that gap, and I hope this book may help do that.
What do we know differently now that we didn't know, say, 16 years ago?
Well, we've refined our knowledge. Study after study is reinforcing that what children need is play and not just a special kind of play, which is unstructured free play, the ideas coming from the child. This doesn't seem too radical, except that we're not giving them as much space and time to do that. If you look at the typical preschool or kindergarten now, there's a lot of sitting down and drilling the academics because the curriculum is getting a lot more accelerated than it used to be. I've talked to a kindergarten teacher who told me that the toys grow dusty in her classroom.
So there's a push-pull here, though. The push is that coming up after preschool, they are going to be getting into academics, and they are expected to come to kindergarten now prepared to learn to read, if not reading already.
Well, that's the whole topic of getting young kids ready for kindergarten. That's a huge topic for families.
Kindergarten used to be what you used to get ready for school.
Right, and it's all shifted down. But the thing is that the children haven't changed. So they're on the same evolutionary track they've always been, and our policies are trying to force them into speeding things up. But what young kids really need to get ready for school, to get ready for first grade, and is basic emotional and social coping skills. What they really need is two things. One is how to cope with their intense emotions and express those emotions appropriately. And the second thing is how to encounter conflict and resolve it appropriately. If kids can have practice doing those two things, then they will have developed the skills they need to succeed well in school when it is time for academics.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Heather Shoemaker. She's an author and journalist. Her book is called It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. If you have a story to share about your own efforts to raise your children, if you have some rules you think are renegade-ish, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there, and you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. There are 29 renegade rules in the book, but you said that it can be summed up in one. It's okay if it's not hurting people or property. Now, the question I have to that is, what is hurtful surely rests in the eye of the beholder. So how do you define that?
Well, this rule is what I call the renegade golden rule, because it really does cover all bases. You don't have to remember too much if you can remember that. If play is starting to hurt another a child's body or another person's body, well, that's where you draw a line. If they're going to, people are not for hurting, not their bodies and not their feelings. So it's not just physical hurt. It's also teasing and mean words and things like that. If the play is getting rambunctious, there's absolutely nothing wrong with boisterous play, loud play, active play. But sometimes the location is wrong or the timing is wrong. So if you want to play that game, you need to go take it outside. You can't do it where you might knock over the lamp. I think it's actually pretty clear when something is going to hurt a person or property or an animal, something living.
In a note to us that you sent us, you said you couldn't wait to share your controversial parenting ideas with us. And I was wondering, what's the most controversial idea in your book, in your opinion?
You know, it's funny, Anne, because people have had very individual reactions. I'll give you a couple of them just to let you know the variety that people have reacted to. My editor was most worried about the rule called sex ed begins in preschool. That's the one that she just raised her eyebrows about. Are you sure you want to put this one in the book? But very few other people have reacted to that one. A lot of people worry about the ones called let your children hit and kick. And there's another one called only punch your friends. Now, one of them is about anger and expressing emotions appropriately. So let your children hit and kick is going to be, if they're angry, let that hitting and kicking motion go towards a substitute target. You can't hit me, you can hit the sofa. You can't hit your brother, you can punch the pillow. So that's an anger expression one. But the one about only punching your friends, that is a celebration of roughhousing and rough and tumble play.
And then the sex ed?
Well, you know,
which you conveniently dropped off the
That one, it's about a lifelong attitude towards education and communication with our children. So I started sex ed with my oldest child when he was 2. And I was pregnant at the time, and it was the perfect opportunity to answer his questions as they came up. We got library books that explained how bodies worked. And really, for young children, I think there's 2 main topics for sex ed. One is that they understand the names and parts of and functions of all their parts of the body, and that they know that for boys and for girls and how they're different. And then how babies are made. And it's very easy, if you're nervous about this, to start off when children are young, because they're such a forgiving audience, and they don't even know to be embarrassed. So if you find yourself tripping up over this topic, the younger you start, the easier it is, and it becomes an ongoing conversation.
And they don't have all the salacious references to sex that you do by the time, even nowadays, when you're in the 4th or 5th grade.
Well, sure. And the thing about 4th and 5th grade or 3rd grade or 2nd grade is that if you're not the one who teaches your kids these things, they will learn misinformation from their peers, because children will pass around information and they won't all have it right. But they're interested. And if a child is old enough to ask, they're old enough to get an honest answer.
I remember the film strip in 5th grade, and I remember walking out still not having the foggiest idea what they were talking about. Marion and Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Marion, and I was calling just to say, what a fantastic mom. Fantastic. I raised my kids very much the same way, even had a summer camp where we had some very easy rules. And instead of rules about no running, no this, no that, it was a yes rule. And the yes rules were be safe, have fun, be kind, and have more fun. And that pretty much takes care of life in a lot of situations. And doesn't mean parents don't get involved, but it does mean that kids understand. And anyway, thank you for writing the book. It's going to help so many people.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you. Bye.
Did you want to respond to that?
Well, I just think she's expressing an idea of, you know, letting the kids have their own time to sort things out with some parental guidance from time to time. But that's something that we're forgetting a lot. A lot of parents now are so involved and trying to play judge and referee over every child's squabble. One thing that's important is for kids to encounter conflict on their own. And they may need guidance of how to cope with the conflict, but for them to be able to realize that they themselves can set a boundary on a peer. They don't have to call, Mom, you know, I need you. They can realize that they have the power, if they don't like something, to speak up, not to be a doormat, to speak up and set the limit and say, I don't like that. We can even guide children who are as young as 2 to take a stance where it's a strong stance, put their hand out. They don't even need to speak if they're too young or too shy, but they can learn to set a boundary. And the other child then learns to listen, and they listen back and forth. They're not listening to the adult. It's the child. And if a child whispers or gets too quiet, we can help repeat. I heard John say he doesn't like it when you pushed him. We just repeat his words directly to the child so that they are listening peer to peer and that they can solve their own problems. The solutions children come up with are often much more inventive, and they make more sense, and the children will follow those ideas successfully than the ones we come up that are a little bit arbitrary sometimes.
One idea that you share in the foreword of the book is that it's okay not to apologize when a child accidentally hurts someone. And I was wondering about the theory behind that, because I can tell you that the time, I mean, even if you do something accidentally, the person that it's done to doesn't necessarily know it was an accident. And I always apologize if I rear-end somebody or accidentally knock them with my elbow when I'm turning around in a line somewhere. Right. I mean, just an accidental, oh, I'm so sorry.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
Well, there is a rule called don't make your kids say sorry. And this is because saying sorry is an important part of our culture. And we do expect that adults and people will say sorry. However, when we're trying to teach children social customs and help them develop a sense of remorse and caring about other people, awareness of other people, and they're young, instead what they're learning, so we force them to say sorry. You can't force remorse. Young children, some of them don't feel sorry yet. Some of them do, but they don't feel at that moment. What young children are learning is that at a very early age, they learn that they can say sorry, and it's a magic word, and it gets them off the hook. No responsibility, no remorse. They just say sorry, and that's it. They can walk away. So what I prefer is to involve the child in taking action. Young kids are very good at going to get something. Go get a tissue. Bring it back. Go get an ice pack. Go get somebody's mom or dad. And then bring them back to the scene. Point out what they did. Maybe you didn't know, but your arm hit his body when you were going by in your trike, your arm hit his body. Oh, they didn't know that. It was pointed out to them. Look, he's crying. It really hurts. Point out the consequences. And then ask for a meaningful guarantee. So instead of saying sorry, which often is empty, mm-hmm. have the child say, I won't push you again. I won't knock down your castle again. Now that's meaningful. The other child who feels wronged, that means something. They now feel safe. Oh, he's not going to do that again. I'm okay. I'm safe. And the child who makes a promise tends to live up to it. They make a promise peer-to-peer. They're going to live up to it.
My guest is Heather Shoemaker. She's an author and journalist. We're talking about her new book. It's called It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Americans in many parts of the world found themselves targets after an anti-Islam film sparked riots from Egypt to Indonesia. And it's not just Americans. In China this week, protests and violence targeted Japanese. I'm Neil Conan, working under fire. Plus, rethinking a general often blamed for fumbling away a chance to win the Civil War. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 63 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 76 today, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 53. Support 89.7 NPR News right now and register to win an iPad. Our fall membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge right now, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad. No pledge is necessary, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. The deadline is October 11th. Thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. And support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Heather Shoemaker. She's an author and journalist, and we're talking about her new book, It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. If you have special rules, if you think they're a little bit renegade and you want to share them with us in terms of child rearing, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Heather, the inspiration for your book came from your experiences at the School for Young Children in Columbus. We're going to bring in the director of the school in just a few minutes, but first I wanted you to talk about that, because was it something that suddenly occurred to you when you became a parent? You looked back and thought, oh, I remember that school I went to. How did you just go back and grasp that and embrace it in such detail?
Well, first of all, I did attend the school as a 4- and 5-year-old, but not only that, my mother has been a teacher there for the past 38 years.
Okay.
So I never really left the school.
Okay.
I grew up steeped in its culture. But still, I had moved out of state, and I had gone away, and I did become a mother. When my first child was of preschool age, I had such rosy memories of preschool, because the School for Young Children in Columbus really meets children's needs, and I had remembered that. So I looked around for a school just like it, where I live in northern Michigan, and I struck out time after time. I had not realized how unique it was.
How did you look for it? How did you interview the schools to determine whether or not they fit the bill?
I would observe a class.
Okay.
And I ended up observing 10 schools. Only one of them came close. But really, most of them said they were all based on the philosophy of play, which is what I was looking for. But when I went into the classrooms and really observed, I noticed it was structured activity after structured activity. The only playtime was the 5 to 10 minutes in between when the teacher was busy setting up the next activity, in many cases. And there was a lot of drilling the reading and the math throughout the day. So children weren't able to really engage in free play. And at that time, I went back to Columbus, and I revisited the School for Young Children.
Wondering if maybe you just made it all up in a fantasy world.
Yeah, I wanted to see. And I had actually forgotten how bold it was. I mean, I'd forgotten that they give children boxing gloves and allow them to have boxing and wrestling matches as part of the classroom. And this is a school that devotes an entire room to big muscle running, jumping, climbing activities. And so they welcome this as a form of play. And I'd forgotten they were allowed to climb trees and paint them purple. So the creativity and the risk-taking and the welcoming of active energy, I had forgotten they'd gone that far. And it delighted me. And that's when I decided that I needed to write this book to share the ideas with parents, because they were so unusual and because they helped. I was a confident parent of young children, but people around me were worried when their kids picked up a stick and said bang.
Yeah. Joining us now is Stephanie Rottmeyer.
That's right.
Director for the School for Young Kids. Is it the School for Young Kids?
The School for Young Children is
young
the name
children,
of it.
Right.
Yes. We call it SYC.
Okay. Young Children. That's why that director for the School for Young Children, a preschool in Clintonville that inspired the philosophy of Heather Shoemaker's book. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Oh, thank you so much.
So Heather writes in the book that the School for Young Children does not have a name for its philosophy necessarily. So can you tell us about the genesis of it and where it came from in the first place?
Certainly. It started in 1969. And the two women that started it, Lee Rowe and Janet Stocker, had a vision of a school that they would like to be a child in, I think is what they really thought. And so they developed this program and based in play and with child choice of play themes and large chunks of free play so that children could really get into the play. Even though it's a part-time program, the classes are 2.5 hours each.
Okay.
So we devote most of the time to free play.
So it's not a daycare center, then?
Not at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of kindergarten for me.
Yeah,
I don't remember ever really having to learn anything. I just remember reading time. The teacher would read to us, and then it was like this incredible playground, indoor playground of stuff
exactly.
to do.
Yes, and we really believe that play is the way children learn best. So that's the basis of it.
How do you interview people to work there? I mean, everyone sort of has to be on the same page, right? How do you find the right personalities to work there?
It's interesting. We do a lot of hiring of teachers from our parent base. And that's actually how I started. I started in 1976 as a parent at the school. And I started volunteering more time because it felt so good to be there. And after that, I volunteered quite a lot. They finally asked me to come on the staff. And
look at you now.
Yeah, look at me now. Still there.
How do you prepare parents for the role in the process? Because I would imagine there are parents who think this is where they want their kids to go because it sounds so great. But sometimes they're not really necessarily bought into the follow-through.
Absolutely. We ask all the families to come in and do a good visit before they even think of signing up so that they can have a tour and ask all the questions. We try to bring out the questions a little bit when they're on the tour. And we also have a parent orientation night in the fall that parents have to come to, and we really go through the philosophy carefully at that time. And we have a lot of printed material and written material on our website so that people can really get some of the ideas before they come. And I think that we invite them to be in the classroom as much as they want to be so that they really know what's going on.
And, you know, are they fully aware of the philosophy before they enroll their children
necessarily? Pretty much so, yes.
Because there's the Montessori method, which is kind of iconic now. Mm-hmm. It's been spread across the world. Mm-hmm. And you're still in Clintonville.
Right.
With this one school.
Right. Well, there's a lot of word of mouth, of course. Since we've been there since 1969, mm-hmm. we have a lot of parents coming to the school now that actually went to the school. And so they're bringing their children now. And so we're pretty well known in the Columbus area, at least. We've done a lot of work with OSU, and we've done some other writing projects nationally so that we are known a little bit nationally.
And to what extent do you try to accommodate differing family cultures within the school? Because things are much more diverse now than they were perhaps back in 1976. So how do you do that? Because different cultures have different ideas about discipline and about space and personal space and that kind of thing.
Well, like you were talking about before, we really try to make it evident what the program is all about. And we want families to come and observe carefully and see if it's a good fit for their family. It might not necessarily be, but we're welcoming to everyone. And we work real closely with families all the time. So it's not just working with the children, it's working with the whole family unit. We have parent education evenings, and we try to have the whole family involved so that the more that happens, the more we understand each other. And that's always a common goal of doing what's best for the child.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Heather Shoemaker, when you went back to observe, can you tell people what exactly you saw?
Well,
as an adult versus a 5-year-old,
I saw children putting on pint-sized purple and red boxing gloves and having a rip-roaring fun game between partners. And when a problem came up, a teacher would say, "It looks like you didn't like that." And the kids would say, "Yeah, I don't like it when you hit my ear." And then the teacher would get out a magic marker and help them, because they couldn't read or write, dictate what their rules were. So it would say Jamie and John's rules for boxing, and they'd write down every time they had a new one, no touching ears, no pulling shirts, until they had established their own rules for that game. And they might continue that game for a half hour, 40 minutes, because they're having so much fun, and they have listened and negotiated together to make it successful.
That's a lot of time of one teacher spending with two kids.
Well, there's usually a teacher. They have three teachers in the class. Usually one's outside, because there's not a set outside time. As long as there's an adult outside, the kids can go out even if it's raining.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's usually a quiet area room, and then there's the running room, which is the room where the boxing and wrestling and jumping and screaming is welcomed. So there's usually a teacher in that room as well. There can easily be a teacher guiding a boxing match who is not doing it 100%. They are there when they're needed, and then they're helping somebody else put a dress up with the zipper, you know, on their back, or they're helping somebody lift something to make a climber a certain way. So they're not just watching those two kids. They're watching a group of children. The kids are mostly working out their roles by themselves, and they only need guidance once in a while.
You know, some rules at daycare centers are rules because it's the way our culture has evolved with rules over kids. But I imagine some of the rules are also for liability purposes and injuries and that sort of thing. And I was wondering, you were saying they let the kids climb the tree, which is great, but has there been any restrictions on what you can let the kids do?
Well, we have to follow licensing regulations. Mm-hmm. And so we try to give the kids as much freedom as possible within the regulations. Mm-hmm. And so for a tree climbing, we would bring out the mats. Mm-hmm. to be under the tree. We have a teacher okay. standing by the tree.
Okay, and, it's the safest tree climbing thing you'll
exactly.
ever experience. Ever
so,
have.
You know, it's fun to the kids because it feels risky, but it really is safe.
okay. Yeah. An email from Gina in Clintonville. She says, there was a 2011 Yale and Harvard Medical School study that showed excessive crying is harmful to young brains. That research guided me to not sleep train or use the cry it out method. I was shocked at the science. So what about that when kids are expressing themselves that way, either screaming or crying? And, you mm-hmm. know, we've all seen that or been there.
Just this morning, I was at the school visiting, and it's the beginning of the school year, and the kids are young, and some of them are really missing their mothers and fathers as they leave.
Oh, yes, there's that.
And so the separation issues there are huge at this age. One little girl was crying and bawling and pulling on her mom's shirt, didn't want her to leave. What happens next is magical. The mother says goodbye, the teacher says, we will take good care of you. And then they get out a pen and a piece of paper. They draw a picture of the sad face with the tears coming down, and they help write a letter. Dear Mommy, I miss you. I'm sad. I'm crying. I want you to come home, and sign the name of the child. And the tears dried up so fast because their emotions were being respected and being expressed. Their deepest feelings were being heard, and they could see both with the picture and they could hear the words being read over to them, that their needs were being met and that it was okay to feel sad. And when that happened, they still felt a little bit sad their mom had left, but it was okay. They knew they would be taken care of. And that happens every day. If a child falls down and skins their knee, the same letter can come out. I hurt. I fell down. My knee's bleeding. I miss you. With a picture of tears. Using this powerful literacy tool to write with children who are too young to read and write. So instead of drilling the ABCs, taking that moment, that emotional moment, and turning it into a meaningful literacy lesson, that's what it's all about.
Candace in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Candace.
Hi. Hi, everyone. Congratulations on the book. I am so thrilled to have two copies, Heather, and want to share it with my own children. I was a parent who sent my kids to SYC, and also became a teacher, as Stephanie mentioned, was kind of a pattern. And I learned so much as a parent and as a person from that school. I wanted to say that, to tell my story of the first visit I made, I was looking around at many kinds of schools, and I entered a room where there was a circle time going on with children gathered on the rug, and a teacher had a pad of paper, a big easel, and she was telling the kid, it was the day after the Challenger disaster. And she was drawing for the kids in a very simple and non-scary and non-threatening way, and very factually telling them what had happened, because she felt that they were hearing and picking up on parents' concerns and not knowing what to make of it. And I just knew right then that my children would be emotionally safe at this school, and that was my experience throughout. So I'm so thrilled that that now all this wisdom has been collected into a book, and can't wait to pass it on.
All right, Candace, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Has the school changed much since Heather was a student there?
You know, one of the things that's been important to us is to keep that same philosophy right from the start. And even through all the tides of the different educational theories up and down, we've remained constant with knowing that children need to have good, solid play and learn through play. And so we've only had four directors in the entire time since 1969, and we've all been connected with the school. For instance, I started teaching in 76, mm-hmm. and then I've been the director for the last 8 years. And before me, another teacher was the director for 17 years. So we've been able to hold that philosophy consistent because of that, I think. And we have many teachers there who've been there for many, many years, including Heather's mom, who's been there since 1973 as
so
a teacher.
So there's that consistency, that constancy.
Definitely.
Let's get to the title of the book, because you, what you did is you picked the classic, you know, that we're taught. Everyone's, you know, you got to share. You have to share. And the title of the book is It's Okay Not to Share. That refers to rule number 10, which is let her hog the toy all day. Tell us about that, Heather.
Yes, I'd be glad to. You know, I actually had to break up the sharing rule into two. One is all about it's okay not to share. And then the second one, hog the toy all day, is what happens when somebody keeps holding on to something for a long, long time. So we have tips on that, too. You know, what we ask children to do as adults, we ask them to share on demand. So right when they're busy using something, when they're engaged in playing with an object, we ask them to give it up as soon as another child asks for it. And that feels terrible, that giving up, because they're being interrupted. They're at their optimal learning, engaged with something. They're asked to stop that and give something up on demand. And so instead, SYC has developed, and this is what I'm sharing in the book, a system of child-directed turn-taking. You know, I've had women in their 70s come up to me and say, I'm still bitter that I had to share with my sister. I mean, this is something children feel deeply and unfairly. And because it feels so terrible, it gives sharing a bad name. They don't do it if they don't have to. They certainly don't do it when we're not watching. We're trying to help children become generous and become aware of other people, but it actually backfires.
Kind of like the same idea of saying, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
It's the words, right. It's not the actions.
And so a way to be very clear for children and be fair and to really engage that generosity and compassion is to tell the child, you can have it until you're all done. You can keep using it till you're all done. I see Jimmy's waiting. He wants to play with that truck. You can play with it till you're all done. And then they can learn to say, I'm not done yet. You can have it when I'm all done. Now, all done might vary from child to child. It might be 5 seconds and they drop it. It might be an hour. It's going to depend. But long turns are respected. Long turns are okay. And the waiting child knows that, yes, they're having a long turn right now, but you can have a long turn too when it's your turn. So then what happens when the child is all done? This is a joyous moment. They drop it, and if they don't remember, you can remind them, remember Jimmy was waiting. And so then they pick up the toy without any more prompting, rush over to him, and hold it out with a smile on their faces and say, here you go. And it's that moment we're looking for, because it's that moment when they experience that rush of good feelings, when they feel inside of themselves what generosity feels like, what caring about others feels like. They're not being forced. It's coming from inside. And that's a feeling that they will want to repeat again and again, even if we're not watching. So then for the waiting child, of course, waiting can be difficult. But this is teaching such a better skill set. Delayed gratification and impulse control are skills that we want to help children acquire instead of instant reward.
You're listening to Heather Shoemaker, author and journalist. We're talking about her new book, It's Okay Not to Share, and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. We're going to say goodbye now to Stephanie Rottmeyer, director of the School for Young Children. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to hear from a former daycare worker at another school, a current stay-at-home mom, and also who's been well-educated in early childhood education as well. So we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio by the Society of Professional Journalists for the third year in a row.
The first responding officers were confronted by lions, tigers, a grizzly bear.
She's a single mom with four children. She works as a part-time medical assistant. She makes only $1,300 a month.
Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and at our award-winning website, WOSU.org.
63 degrees in downtown Columbus. Thanks for joining us today. Sunshine and a high of 76. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 53. More sunshine with a slight chance of rain on Friday, a high of 74. Support for 89.7 comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about parenting this hour with author Heather Shoemaker. Her new book is called It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. Joining us now, Angie Marin. She's a full-time mom who also has a bachelor's degree in early childhood education. She earned a master's in education, and she worked for 5 years at a child care facility on the OSU campus. Welcome to the show, Angie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So have you been listening to the conversation?
I have.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of credential behind you. And I was wondering, besides what we're talking about right now, after all of that education, does the theory stack up to the real deal?
Yes, there's a lot of, theorists and stuff we learned about in school, but and that's all good, great things. And then it's the working with the children and what works for them, and those all, everything they were talking about is exactly what I do at my house and what we did at the OSU child care program.
Heather Shoemaker was saying earlier that it's very, very difficult to find a program like the one that inspired the book, like the School for Young Children. So people out there like you are being educated. People are being educated to open schools like this, but there aren't very many like this.
That's very true. It's very hard to find quality preschools and quality child care programs, and a lot of that comes with a cost, too, when you do find them.
Yeah. What did you find the greatest challenge when you went from your theoretical background to becoming a full-time mom of two kids?
I thought it was a little bit of an adjustment just going from teaching in a classroom and being with the same children every day and being in the same room. Where at my house, we go to the zoo or we're going to the grocery store, and you got to keep doing life outside of a small room. And so sometimes you will get those things you were talking about early about, another parent child might hit my child at the playground, and that parent might make my daughter be upset if I don't make them say sorry or something like that. So that's kind of the biggest change I've run into.
It's out in the real world. It's not all perfect. So Heather Shoemaker, right, you're dealing with this too. You're a parent. You don't have a school like this for your children. You're out there in the real world. How do you make that leap from the philosophy and the theories in your book to out in a world where not everybody not only subscribes to it or might disagree with it?
Right. Well, there's certainly, every parent knows there's a huge variety of family cultures and parenting styles out there. And of course, there's many right ways to raise a child. But when we do go to the playground and encounter different styles, if my child is on the swing longer than somebody else's, for example, there can be a potential conflict there. Adults are very afraid of conflict, and so they try to minimize it when their kids are about to encounter it, and they try to minimize it between themselves. Sometimes I make separate rules for a public place. So I might be following as long a turn as you want when we're home. And if we arrive and I notice the playground's extremely crowded, I might say, I see there's a lot of kids at the playground today. Today is a day we're going to take short turns. But set the expectations ahead of time and tie it to an observation so that next time maybe the kids will start to notice themselves, oh, it's really crowded today. Maybe I better give someone else a turn. So sometimes setting a different set of rules for a public place. But other times, it's a way of educating other families without being pushy about it. So, for example, if one of my kids loves weapon play and superhero and that kind of play, so if he picks up a stick on the ground at the playground and starts to do that kind of play, a lot of parents around me might get nervous because they don't know if that's okay with me or with somebody else or if it's okay in general. And I'll often just say something to set their fears aside and say, it's okay with me if it's okay with you, if they're playing together, the two kids. And sometimes that's all that's needed for them to relax. Other times it's not okay. And then we'll just say, it looks like you're uncomfortable with that. And so we'll move our play to another part of the playground. We don't all have to agree about this, but we need to be respectful of each other.
Yeah, we have an email from Jen. She says, how can I politely and compassionately explain to other parents in the heat of the moment during a playground conflict that it's okay not to share? And you're saying not everybody necessarily agrees with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, sharing is a tricky one in a public place among strangers because parents are so concerned that their child behaves well, behaves kindly and nicely, that they will swoop in instantaneously to give the They'll rip the toy out of their own child's hands and give it to yours if that's what's going on before you have a chance to open your mouth sometimes. So sometimes it's just not possible and just let things go. I mean, as a parent, you have to learn to go with the flow. Other times, if you're around neighbors or friends that you know them a little better, you can start to say things ahead of time. In a public place, sometimes you can be aware. I find just by knowing people are going to react quickly, I can say something out loud, which is expressing my parenting views by saying, it's okay for her to keep the toy. You know, just it's okay with me if she keeps the toy. My child can wait. And say that out loud, then that might be all that they need to relax on the sharing issue. But it is going to depend on the situation. It's not always going to go the same way each time.
Angie Mirren, you have your bachelor's degree in early childhood education, a master's in education. How well prepared did you feel when you actually got into the real world and also worked at the child care facility on the OSU campus?
I got my master's as I was working at OSU, so I did my undergrad before that.
Mm-hmm.
Going into it, I feel a lot of it you learn through my coworkers and just the experience of experiencing different situations, because in the classroom, you can talk about different situations, but when you're actually facing it in reality, because all the children are different and every situation is going to be different, and you can mock situations, but everything is not going to be the same as that. So a lot of it you just learn through experience and the different situations, and you get to know the children and how to talk to them and stuff like that.
When you're thinking of this book, Heather, how are you incorporating the experiences of parents who have children who have different kinds of issues, not necessarily learning disabilities, but emotional disabilities, those kinds of things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have anecdotes throughout the book, and some of the anecdotes include special needs children in the book, some of them having to do with wrestling matches, some to do with sharing issues. So, you know, kids with special needs of all varieties are part of our communities, and they are part of all of us, even if they're not in our families. We're going to encounter these kids. So I wove them into the stories of the book because all kids, they're all, you know, they're all individual, and then some have special needs on top of that. But still, there are basic things that have to do with respect for the child's play ideas and respect for their emotions and helping them develop a way to express those emotions appropriately. So the way we do that may turn out to be a little different depending on the specific child. But at a basic level, all children have the same needs: the need for play, the need to feel safe, the need to have their rights respected, the need to be able to set limits on other people. And so there's very strong common themes that apply to all children here.
Angie Mirren, we were talking earlier about how so much of preschool now is geared toward getting kids ready for school. And whereas, you know, a zillion years ago when I was in kindergarten, that was kind of what it was for, was to socialize. Now it starts in preschool. What are they teaching you? What are the universities teaching now about that and what the purpose of preschool is?
Well, we talked a lot about getting children ready for preschool. To some people, that means they need to learn to sit and they need to learn to write their name and read all before you get to kindergarten. But in reality, what we were talking about at, in my classes is that getting ready really just means that, you know, they can have a conversation with peers. They can interact and they kind of learn the hidden rules of school by just kind of the structure of it and mingling with other people. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have to go into kindergarten learning to read. They'll get there at their own level, and the kindergarten teachers will get them there too. So
everyone keeps saying that they'll get there, but some kids don't get there. Some kids get there, where they're going to get is going to be much later than what the cookie cutter notion of schools are now. How do you, when you see a kid really, really lagging in a certain skill, what do you do?
Well, you especially, if you're noticing something and you really try to focus on that. Like in preschool, if somebody's really struggling with learning how to, the letters of their name, well, we'll play games with letters with their name. We'll do, if they're working on their color recognition, we'll play color matching games. So it's all in play. And it's things that they're interested in.
And how does that translate, Heather Shoemaker, into your book and what you're saying in your book? Is it's when they're ready and when they want to do a color game is when it's there for them to do? Or how does that work?
Well, as far as getting ready for school, you know, they talk about the age of seven. The age of seven plus or minus one. This is established change that occurs in the brains of kids, and this is universal worldwide. Our brains change around the age of seven, maybe the year before, the year after, and that's about when kids are ready for schooling and academic learning. So before that, some kids may be early readers, but they're not going to be ready, but they're ready for other things. My philosophy is meet their present needs. Don't try to foist on them what they're going to be needing in 2 or 3 years or even next year. Just as we shouldn't, as middle-aged adults, get ready for old age in the nursing home right now. We may know it's coming, but we don't have to practice using a walker today, even though we will need that skill in the future. We need to meet the present needs. You know, the founder of kindergarten, Frederick Feubel, he specifically said that kindergarten should not be a place for children to read or write or cipher. It should be a place for children to interact with other kids and play together. And as Aaron was saying, that's where you're building the skills together. So getting ready is I think we forget when we're focused on literacy and teaching these kids to read and recognize their letters, what early literacy really is all about is awakening that love of stories, that love of language. So nursery rhymes, reading aloud to children, having them do finger chants and finger plays and games, all that is early literacy. Doing these letters I was talking about where they can write, "Dear Mommy, I'm sad," with somebody's help, that's early literacy too. Scribbling on a piece of paper. But those are all early literacy. They're not sitting down and really trying to get it right. Those are just awakening the joy and meaning of language.
Is that something you talked about in college and in your master's program, Angie?
Yes, there was a big focus on in school and then playing out different situations and how would we work with that if a child comes to you that you know, isn't interested in story time. Like if at work, if reading a book and somebody wasn't interested, we didn't force them to come over and sit down because that gave them a negative feeling towards stories, and we wanted them to come naturally towards it. So we would slowly introduce that. We might do a book with them one-on-one. Maybe that was more interesting to them than in a whole group setting. And eventually they learned to love the stories and they would join circle time, but we didn't want them to have a harsh feeling towards it.
We have a quick note from Beth on Facebook. She writes, I am a toddler teacher at a local child care center, and I work hard to create this kind of environment for my kids. Often I feel like a salmon swimming upstream. It's not necessarily a counterintuitive issue. It's just different than the way most of us were raised.
Well, it's different for many people how they were raised, but also within a school or program setting, it can be different than the program's policies. So if you're an individual teacher, sometimes you may believe these ideas in your heart, but you find it hard to support them in the classroom. So there are some larger issues of policy and the directors of these programs that have to be on board to make it easy for the individual teachers to follow this. But I think if you were raised in a way that you don't care for and you want to try something new but don't really know what to do, there's some really good tips to make life easier as a parent in this book, as far as if you're tired of being judge and referee. So you can have some tools that you may not have thought of before, some of them counterintuitive, that can work.
And just to be really clear, this isn't about... You know, I know somebody who was raised in a really super strict household who let their kids do anything they wanted and kind of run wild in a way, you know, lay down on the bench in the restaurant and take up all the seats in the waiting area of a restaurant while little old ladies are standing around, that kind of a thing. That's not what you're talking about here. There are rules.
Yes. You know, I have a chapter about setting limits because where I feel is that the children need freedom within playtime. So when it's playtime, let them choose their own topics, even if it may seem a little aggressive or violent or something that we don't approve of. In their playtime, as long as they're treating each other well, that's a fine topic. Let them play. But then when it's behavior, you need to set limits on behavior. So if their game is getting too wild, then you need to set a limit on the behavior or change the location. But I think we tend to over-limit play right now. And then we're a lot of us don't impose proper awareness and limits in regular daily behavior. I think it needs to be flip-flopped so that there's clear limits on behavior, but within the arena of play, there's great freedom.
Angie Marin, you're home now full-time, right?
Correct.
Is it different when it's your own children?
In some ways, yes, because... they don't train you in school, for example, like how to get your child to go to bed every night, you know? They don't talk about that. So, yeah, some things, but a lot of the rules that you can, you know, just be clear and consistent with, like she's saying, the limitations, you know, like every night we just say, okay, we're going to read two books before bedtime and then it's time to rest. And they just start learning that this is what's going to happen.
Uh-huh. So, well, Angie Marin, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Angie Marin's a former daycare worker, current stay-at-home mom. She's got a bachelor's in early childhood education, a master's in education. Also, Heather Shoemaker, thanks for joining us today, Heather.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Heather is a journalist and an author. We've been talking about her book, It's Okay Not to Share and Other Renegade Rules for Raising Competent and Compassionate Kids. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.